We're ready to look at Acts chapter 21, verses 25 and 26. At different times in the lives of the first century Christians, Paul certainly would be a good illustration of this. He's not the only one. We've got Peter and John. And I suspect that the people who are not apostles but Christians also had the same kind of thing. When you start looking at these antagonistic Jews, it's almost sort of like flies at a picnic. You are out there and you want to enjoy yourself and all the food is there. And you have to keep swatting away these flies. You have to keep trying to bat away or kill the mosquitoes because it's just irritating. They will not leave you alone. That's sort of what we see at different times in Paul's life, and we're going to find some of that here in Acts chapter 21. While we've still got a couple coming in, remember that he has, with a group of people, collected a lot of money and headed down to the area of Jerusalem. He's finally arrived there. He's met with James and the elders, and he has gone through in, we might say, almost excruciating detail what has happened as far as much of his evangelistic work. Probably shared a lot of information from those missionary journeys. And that brings us to Acts chapter 21, 25, and 26. But it's touching the Gentiles that have believed, we wrote giving judgment that they should keep themselves from things sacrificed to idols and from blood and from what is strangled and from fornication. Then Paul took them in and the next day, purifying himself with them, went into the temple, declaring the fulfillment of the days of purification until the offering was offered for every one of them. A little more information, if you were not in the last couple of classes, when Paul has this meeting with James and the elders, everything is looking pretty good, at least from Paul's perspective. Got the money, didn't get robbed, got it down here, and given them a good report, and we are in a good relationship. Well, James and the elders, they let him finish up, and then they say, by the way, there's some people in town who are going to hear that you have come, and that's not going to be received very well. And it did end up creating some problems, maybe not for the reasons that they thought. And they made a suggestion. They said, we have how many men who have taken a vow, possibly a Nazarite vow? We've got four men. And if you go and you join yourself, you know, you sort of participate at least to some degree in the process, that's probably going to help shut down, tamp down any concern that you are trying to say bad things about Moses' law. And we went through that. Maybe that was a mistake. Possibly that was a sin on Paul's part. Maybe Paul looked at this as something that he could do as far as participating in some Jewish customs, but not in any way violate some part of the Christian life. We just don't have enough information as far as, in my mind, to make a firm declaration. In my younger years, I guess I was more inclined to think that Paul sinned. I think I backed off that some because I'm just not sure we've got enough as far as details there to draw a firm conclusion. Stan, are we going to throw something out or not?
So why did they jump right in the middle of Paul? Why weren't they doing the same thing to the present apostles that were in Jerusalem and the elders that were there? It seems to me like they should have been doing the same thing that Paul was doing. So my question again, why did Paul take the blood of this when he comes into town?
Well, he did get hit with it. A lot of time has passed since Acts chapter 2. And maybe the best parallel that we can make is general in nature. It'd be like a change in the workplace. You want to retire at this job. You've been there for 17 years and you're thinking at 20 I can be out. And maybe they make some management changes or maybe there are some procedural changes and you do not like the changes. But even though you don't like what's going on, you learn to coexist. My impression of Jerusalem is still a strong Jewish presence. Temple is there, you still got the feast, so Judaism has definitely not gone away. But Christianity has been around for maybe 25 years. And the Jews had to learn to coexist with that. They weren't happy about it, just like the guy in the workplace, but you know, we don't really have any choice if we're going to stay here in Jerusalem. Now, if you go back to the illustration that I gave as far as the guy who's only got 3 years to retirement, could there be a set of circumstances which would push him to the point where he would say, I know it's only 3 years, but I'm going to walk? It might have to be extreme, but there could be something that would be so upsetting, so troubling to him. For example, maybe they say we're going to switch to a completely night shift. And he says, I can't stay awake at night. I'm going to have to find another job. So even though he is within eyesight of retirement, he says, you know, kind of bad luck for me. I'm going to have to leave it alone. So there can be sometimes that catalyst, there can be that spark that really changes things. And in this particular case, that would be my explanation for what you posed, that Paul was that catalyst, or he was that spark. And they said, this is going to be just too much. I mean, we've been able to kind of get things along reasonably well up to this point, but your presence, that's going to put things over the top.
Well, I mean, is it possible? It doesn't say in everywhere else that the Jews followed him around and gave him a hard time. It talks about, but that some of those came back into Jerusalem with him, and they were added to the pot.
It could be. I think we got the word Asia used here in Acts chapter 22. We're going to find Trophimus the Ephesian. Let's see if we've got... Anybody see that? Jews from Asia.
27.
Is it 27? Okay. Chief Captain came... Acts 22:27?
Yes.
21.
Oh, 21:27. Okay. I was looking across the page there. There we go. Yeah, the Jews from Asia. So these could have been some of the people that Paul had incited, if you will, while he was working at Ephesus, and they were so angry that they just decided, you know, maybe they were already in Jerusalem because they had come there for the feast. And when, again, just as James and the elders said, when they hear, it could be that there were people who were sort of already in town, and aha, we're going to jump on that bandwagon again. So, but yeah, I do think that they were thinking, we have to do something to keep the peace, because this brings things, your presence, to a whole new level. Okay, let's go back to Acts chapter 21, verses 25 and 26. These elders and James, they reference that decision that was, I hate to say reached, because Acts chapter 15 and verse 28 says it was the Holy Spirit who was the one who said, this is what we need to do with the Gentiles. We're not going to have them circumcised. They don't have to keep any of the Jewish rituals. They do have to, though, if they want to be a Christian. They do have to do the things that we find in Acts chapter 15 and here in Acts chapter 21. They do need to keep themselves from idolatry. If you're going to be a Christian, Jew or Gentile, that's off the table. Carol? Yeah, you know, even Christians are capable of panicking, thinking we've got to do something. Saul is a classic example of that, waiting for the prophet, and it looks like, you know, we're a minute till, and he's not here. We've got to do something, so Saul leaps up and acts, and, you know, when the clock is just ready to strike, God's man shows up. So it could have been that as well. So we have, as far as what the Gentiles were told, you can't be involved with idolatry, you've got to avoid blood. We talked about that, and that would, as far as we can tell, still apply to Christians today. You don't want to drink blood. And then, strangulation would tie in with that. And then, of course, from sexual sin, fornication being the general word from that. So what the Gentiles were told to do, these things were big deals for them. Because if you were a Gentile, you were coming, you know, you drink the blood. Sexual sin was a big problem for them. Idolatry was huge in so many ways. So it was, if you're going to become a Christian, God has said the door is open to you, but you really need to make sure that you watch out for some of those old habits, that they do not interfere with the Christian life. So the Gentiles got squared away. But now, here in Acts chapter 21, it's not the Gentiles that are under consideration. Now it is who? It's the Jews. And they're thinking that Paul is telling them that you have to sever yourself from every aspect of Jewish heritage. If you're going to become a Jew, are there some people who perhaps they leave their homeland and they want to somehow preserve the culture? Anybody ever see that? You work with somebody like that?
That's all the time.
Yeah. Where do you see it?
Well, you're going to see the flag of their country out in the front lawn.
All right.
Probably.
Sometimes it's a flag.
They may put something on their car or truck that tells you that they belong to clubs or organizations that are,
yeah, they want to bring that little, they want to bring that little,
they start them, you know.
Yeah, or maybe some of the dress that they used to wear in home that you might not find in America. Gary?
Yeah, in larger cities they have whole portions of town called Little Italy or Little Rome or whatever, and they tend to congregate in those neighborhoods.
Yeah, and on a smaller scale sometimes a community will say, all right, we're having a certain festival, and it will commemorate maybe an ethnic group or ethnic foods. Anybody familiar with Fat Tuesday?
Yeah.
I had never had one of the Fat Tuesday, Pushki Donuts, does that sound right? Punchki, yeah, thanks, Bonnie. I'd never had one of those donuts until I got involved with the Hummer plant. And there was a guy, I mean, that was his thing. I mean, when that day came, I mean, he would drive for hours to get just the right donuts. They had to be those donuts, they had to be fresh. But I mean, for him, that was part of his connection to his past. Now, we understand that, and if you were a Jew and you had this connection to Jerusalem, this city, and this temple, and this religion, well, go back and look at this information again from a different perspective in just a couple of minutes, and somebody is saying, you've got to strip that all away. You think that's going to upset some people? And you think if you go to the capital city where this is the place for that stuff, and they hear that you've shown up, hey, it is this guy who's trying to strip away all of our heritage. So again, Stan, I think that knocked this up into a completely different category, and James and the elders are thinking, we've gone now from simmering to the house is on fire, and again, Carol's point could very well be exactly right. We have got to do something. And if they did panic, it's not a good example. I mean, it's a good example as far as that can happen to Christians, but not a good example as far as what to do. Maybe more prayer should have been dedicated to this and more thoughtfulness. All right, so the meeting in Acts chapter 15 affirmed that Gentiles did not need to live as Jews. Here we're dealing with the opposite matter. Jewish converts did not need to live as Gentiles. It would be one thing to say, okay, and again, you never know exactly how far these people were going, but they seem to have been pretty determined, and determined people sometimes say anything and everything to make their case. But imagine if there were people who were charging Paul with, he not only wants to strip away our culture, our heritage, our identity, but what else does he want to do? He thinks we should live as Gentiles. Now, you think that was going to get any traction? Ouch! I mean, you want to go ahead and have them rise up and attack somebody? You want to create a flash mob? That's going to do it in the city of Jerusalem. And if they really wanted to be bad, can you say, well, we know what the Gentiles do, right? What are they involved with? They're involved with idolatry. You know, we've got the temple of God here, but what's he want us to do? Run over to those heathen temples. You know, we're trying to be faithful sexually to our wife and not stray outside the marriage, but what's Paul open to? Just go out and sleep with anybody that you... I mean, you can see how this would have easily mushroomed if people had really wanted to create some problems. So James and the elders, maybe they were trying to create some kind of delicate balance to be fair to everybody. But again, it did not go well, as we're going to see here in just a little bit. I do think that there's a practical lesson there, and that is, unless we're compromising doctrinally, we should try to meet people halfway. And that's always good if we can do that. Anything that you want to look at before we pick up with 27 to 29 in Acts chapter 21? Bonnie?
Have you ever known in our day and time in the church where you've been any Jews that were converted?
Not one. I mean, when you start looking at certain groups, Jews, Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, there are some that do come out. Look at the Amish. There are some who leave it, but for the most part, we would say that the majority do not.
And I've heard the term Jews for Jesus before.
Yeah.
But I don't ever know of any that...
Yeah, there is actually an organization. They are... Yeah. They may not exclusively be someone who had been Jewish and became a member of a denominational group, but I would suspect that 99% of them are. And because of their background, the involvement with Judaism, they are uniquely qualified to talk to people. I mean, it would be like if you're trying to convert someone who is a Jehovah's Witness, if you have someone like Bessie Bledsoe. You know, Bessie would, even though she never became a Jehovah's Witness, she had spent enough time there where she would be able to have some personal knowledge and experiences that would line up very well. So we do the same kind of thing today. Sometimes if a person is suffering a loss, we might try to connect them with somebody who's going through the same kind of experience. But very good. Okay, thought I saw the flash. One more hand. Let's pick up in 27 to 29, those verses in Acts 21. And when the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, there we have it, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the multitude and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man that teacheth all men everywhere against the people and the law in this place. And moreover, he brought Greeks, plural, also into the temple, and hath defiled this holy place. For they had before seen him in the city, let's try that again, for they had before seen with him in the city, Trophimus the Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. Was Paul willing to do what the four men were doing, at least to some degree, what James and the elders had proposed? He was. And we get here to the tail end of that. The vows that have been undertaken, you're towards the end of that time period. Luke says that 7-day period that he was describing was almost completed. Then, Stan, this kind of goes back to what you were saying and what somebody pulled out from verse 27. We've got these Jews from Asia. Did they follow Paul down, possibly? Were they in town and word begins to spread and they, oh yeah, we've had experience with him. And maybe it was a combination. We simply don't know, but they did connect. And they were claiming that they saw Paul in the temple, and apparently they acted on impulse. I find that to be kind of interesting. Let's take that in conjunction with what Carol said just a little bit ago. If you have the elders and James acting, shall we say, on impulse, we've got to do something, and this is what we're going to do, and then you've got these Jews over here, they're acting somewhat impulsively as well. Well, if Paul's here, we've got to do something. What kind of situation does that create when you've got two diametrically opposed groups who both feel strongly that they've got to do something, and they're headed in two very different directions?
Riot.
Yeah, you're probably going to have a riot if enough people are involved. This is not going to end well. So you have to kind of see the contrast that Luke is offering here. The Jews, they are agitators, and they begin to agitate who? They stir up the... Oh, okay, is there any other word that's used there? Any other word? All right. Crowd, multitude, it would be the Jews, but we do have this described as well as a significant number of people. Once Paul is in custody, the activists, this is kind of interesting, they cry out for help. Men of Israel, help. Now, do you find that to be kind of odd? Almost funny. I mean, if you've got this mob, how many people are you going after? Just one. Now, unless Paul is showing off some kind of supernatural, miraculous displays, how much effort does it take to take one guy into custody, especially, you know, if, you know, he's not trying to resist, and there's no indication that Paul was?
They want to not be the only ones going after Paul. They want to have a larger crowd.
That's my suspicion.
Comfort in numbers. Or
yes.
Whatever.
Have you ever seen the police show up? You know, you got one guy who needs to be restrained, but how many police pile on him?
Seven.
Well, I'm not looking for an actual number, but yes, it's probably going to be more than one. You know, it could be seven, it could be a dozen, it might be 15. It's kind of like the football team that's out there playing. You know, the guy is already down on the ground, but what happens? Here come four more players. I'll flop on him too. Well, how come? He's not getting up. It's just people do kind of like to pile on sometimes. So that sort of seems to be what's going on here as far as the crowd. All right, so they sort of get things under control with Paul. They catch him, and then what's the claim? He says they taught, or he taught,
all
men. Now, anytime somebody says everybody, watch out. But he taught all men where?
Everywhere.
Doesn't that sound pretty comprehensive? You think that was true? He taught all men everywhere. Well, in that day and time, there was no way he could reach all men everywhere, but it was an exaggeration to make the point. And what were the charges? All men everywhere are being taught by this guy to be what? Against the people. Who do you think the people are, Jews or Gentiles? Be against the Jews and be against the Jewish law, and then also be against the Jewish temple. Now, all those charges were presented as factual, but if you try to, you know, look at the basis for them, the basis that's given here in the text is not all that strong. What is it? Steve, were you going to go in a different direction? Or?
Well, I was kind of going to talk about what you were just talking about. I think they're trying to incite the,
yes,
the passions of people and get them to their side. That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and sometimes when people are being incited, facts or accurate facts are not always what's being used. They really don't care about the facts. It's, let's say something or whatever we need to say to whip people up into a frenzy. And that was the hope here. Stan?
Well, this idea of them crying out, men of Israel, if we go back a couple of verses, we find out that these were Jews from Asia. It doesn't surprise me that they did that, because they were strangers, not as Jews, but strangers as a people in Jerusalem. And they might have felt like, we've got to get them to know that we're the same people, that we're working together here. So it's men of Israel, we're a part of this. We're come and help us take care of this situation.
Yeah. And what, I'm going to go back to my question again. What was the basis, at least in the text that we have before us, for charging Paul with all these things? What's the big item that they bring forth? What did he do, supposedly?
Gentiles in the temple.
Well, Bonnie, you're in the back. We'll start with you.
Just the fact that he was in the temple?
Well, there's a little bit more there. That is true. Was he by himself?
No.
All right, so it's plural. That's interesting. You have only one person named here, Trophimus. He is described as the Ephesian. That indicates that he was from the area of Ephesus, or at least living in Ephesus probably at the time. But not just him. Brought Greeks. I'm sort of thinking, you know, if you, for example, well, let's let you answer the question. Can a person see something and infer from that a lot more than might actually have occurred?
Absolutely.
What would be an example of that? And I'm looking for a negative example. Well, I'll give you one. All right, you're driving by a main road, and there is a heart doctor there. And you see someone, I mean, who's not 90. I mean, you might think with a 90-year-old, you're probably going to have some heart problems. But you see someone coming out of the clinic that's 21. Now, could some people, with just that information that I gave you, infer some really bad things? If they really went wild with what they saw, and I mean, again, it is factual. And again, Paul was definitely in the temple. He's under the vow. But let's parallel that to the heart illustration. You see the 21-year-old coming out of the clinic. What could someone infer?
Wow, someone that young has heart problems.
All right, he has heart problems.
Serious.
It is serious. Okay, he's probably going to die. Now, that really might be a leap, but if someone went from A to the end of the alphabet Z, they could potentially do that, right? Now, just because Paul is in the temple, well, you know, you really don't know why he's in there. He is a Jew. And you have this information about Greeks. If Trophimus was in the temple, and again, we'll say a little bit more about that in a bit, but if Trophimus was in the temple, would you be able to, again, going back to my doctor illustration, be able to infer that Paul took other people in there? Would you? You could, but I'm talking about correct inference. Just because he took one in, that does not mean that he took other people in. When you start saying, well, he's taking Greeks into the temple, that's like saying, I saw somebody come out of the heart clinic and he's going to die. No, you can't run that far afield. You just don't have the evidence for that. Now, maybe he did take more than one, all right? We saw him with one. But here they go from seeing Paul with this fella to, he took the Gentile into the temple. Now, it's interesting. We've seen this word before, but in verse 29, you have this word supposed is how it's going to be rendered in some translations. That word describes a conclusion that people think is true, but it's not.
The thing is, too, they haven't even seen in the temple. They just
Yeah, and that very well could be true. For most of the people in the mob, maybe they didn't even know who Paul was. But you get this rabble-rousing going on, and you have this mob created, and people are no longer thinking. They're just acting.
Well, they hadn't even seen him in the temple.
Yes, there's...
They've just seen him in the city with Paul.
Yeah.
Not in the actual temple.
Yeah. I'm going to say a little bit more about that, but we're going to hold on for that just a little bit. One source said, I like the quote, he said, with their emotions high and their brains in neutral. These men apparently thought wherever Paul went, his Gentile friends went. I think that's probably about what happened. And Paul was seen in the temple, therefore his friends had been in the temple too. Now, they may not have reasoned exactly that way, but I, based on the information that we have, think that that is pretty sound reasoning, and we call that the logic of prejudice. Anything that you want to add or ask before we say a little bit more? Stan?
This may seem a little facetious, but it probably is more understandable. The neighbor's dog breaks its chain. and he starts to run all over the neighborhood. People don't like having dogs that are, especially aren't their own, running through their yards and whatever. And so somebody gets up in the air. We got dogs all over the neighborhood.
Yes.
We're having, we got to do something about this. And so-and-so says, well, I saw one here, I saw one there. It was all the same dog. He was just running all
yeah,
over.
Yeah, one becomes ten.
That's right. And before long, you've got the whole neighborhood in an uproar over one dog that broke his chain and got loose.
Yeah, and that happens with a lot of the issues that we have. That's been one of the most frustrating things. There are companies, for example, a child chokes on a toy. Now, the toy has been around for 35 years, and millions of kids have had the toy. But all of a sudden, it is we've got to sue the manufacturer and stop the production of that toy, and they do some other things. Well, you know, all right, you know, a child did die. That is terrible. Some financial compensation needs to be given to the family. All those things can be looked at, and perhaps correctly. But people oftentimes will take a piece of information and run far afield with it when the evidence is simply not there. Gary?
This, what they said, men of Israel, help, this is the man. This is the man. It's not, hey, he's doing this. It's, he's the man. So, like, they've been talking about him before and getting the emotions riled up.
Yes.
And then when people are riled up, then they want to know who, and they want to be able to point it at something.
Where is he? We'll go get him.
Exactly.
And then, you know, you got your 10 football players. He's over there. And then everybody makes a mad rush. Yeah, and that is right. But that is one of the tactics that people will use in this kind of circumstance. And it's used very, very effectively. It has been for a long time. Don?
What did we see in January 6th?
Yeah,
just
sure.
For example,
at the Capitol, absolutely.
A small group of people excited the whole crowd. So we see what happens when that ignites.
Yeah, and as we said before, especially if you have people on two opposite extremes, somehow connected or working against each other, and yet they join up somehow, it becomes volatile in a hurry. This is not new stuff. All right, let's think about the Jews a little bit and why they might have been so upset with Christians. Now, we know, remember Matthew chapter 23 and verse 15, Jesus talked about some of the Jewish leaders. He says, you'll compass, you'll go around land and sea to create one proselyte. So not every Jew, because they really didn't want the Gentiles, and if you're a Jew, you were born into the covenant with God. But at least some Jews were really involved with evangelism. They were familiar with that, converts. But what if you're a Christian? It's not we've got just maybe the Pharisees going out and looking for converts. With these Christians, who are they talking to? Everybody and their brother. You know, we're tired of the offers to study the Bible. We're tired of hearing about Jesus and all that stuff. So that would have been one point of contention. Then, as we think about the Jews or something else, we find that the Jewish people, they had that temple. But then these Christians show up, and they talk about the same God, but they say, well, this God that you've been worshiping for a while in the tabernacle, for a long time in the temple, this God still desires worship. You can still worship him, but where would you go for worship? What Jesus said in John chapter 4? Woman, neither this mountain nor that mountain, where can you go to worship God when it comes to the New Testament?
Anywhere.
Anywhere. You know, you probably don't want to be outside in a day like this, but we could meet outside and we could meet in a barn. I mean, there would be 1,000 different places where we might meet. Do you think that would be upsetting to the Jews? You don't have to have the temple. Sell it. Scrap it. Melt down the gold. That would not have gone over very well. And then if you were a Jew, you're thinking about those priests. You've got the special tribe, the Levites, and you've got the high priest, and that's all a very elaborate system and a lot of pomp, a lot of ceremony, and you feel real spiritual when you go over and hand over your sacrifice. And these Christians are running around and saying, there is no high priest as far as a man anymore. You think that would raise some eyebrows? Yeah. And the tribe of Levites, well, you might be able to trace your tribe, but the Levites are no longer special. That's going to cause some people to... I was talking with this lady the other day. I didn't ask her, and she's crinkling her nose every time she listened to me. I thought, well, I'm not quite sure what the nose crinkling... I'd never noticed anybody that crinkled her nose that much. So I thought maybe that is upsetting to her. I don't know. I didn't ask. But anyway, you can see people sometimes, they get really, really agitated. And then we've got some other things here. As far as the priests, Christians, every Christian is a priest. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 5 and 9. So Paul, as all of this is taking place, he's finally charged with what? King James uses the word polluted, and that doesn't mean he's throwing trash around. It means that he was, in terms of the temple, what was he doing? He was desecrating. He was defiling the temple. And if you're able to spread that information, chances are some people are going to be coming after you. Now, this is the first time, either directly or indirectly, that Paul has faced a mob in the book of Acts. Maybe he faced some others, but this is at least time number 6. When you look at his life, Jesus had told him that you're going to be a chosen vessel. Some interesting things are going to happen to you. You're going to do a lot of good things, but you're going to take your fair share of licks, Paul, and he certainly did. Now, let's go back to where I kind of stopped Betty a little earlier. Several of us have seen pictures of the temple, and we know where the most holy place is. High priests would go in there. We've got the holy area. Priests can go in there. And then if you start moving to the outer courts, after you've got the most holy place and you've got the holy place, priests are in those areas. And then you move out a little bit more and you've got another court. You've got another area, still fairly large. And who could go in there?
Women. Women?
No.
Gentiles.
No. I knew we'd get it. The men. Moving from the priests out a little bit, you got the males. And then after you have that area for the guys, you know, they talk about the man cave. That wasn't quite what it was. But again, that's where the men hung out. You move out a little bit further, and then we've got another court. And what's in that next court?
The women.
Now we've got the women out there. And if you were not authorized to be in any of those courts or areas, then we move out one more, and it was a court for who? All right, that one was going to be a court for the Gentiles. Now, if you were a Gentile and you decided that you wanted to try to move into one of those inner courts, even if it was just the court, you might, you know, this is just where the women are hanging out. I'm a guy. So, I'm not going to go over to the Jewish men. I'm just going to go over to where the Jewish women are. Anybody know what that would have resulted in? Huh? Death. There were actually, they found at least one inscription as far as temple walls. And I didn't bring down the exact wording, but basically it said, if you go beyond this point, your blood will be on your head. You will be responsible for your own death. It's like those warning signs I've talked about a couple times in class over the years as far as military bases. If you cross this fence, if you move beyond this line, deadly force is authorized. Well, this sign would have been a little bit different. It wouldn't be authorized. It would be used, even if you were a Roman citizen. I'll give you this now. I'm not quite sure where it is in the notes. I want to make sure that I don't forget it. Josephus records an incident in the temple, which is really a fascinating incident. You kind of have to be careful with him and his history. But anybody ever have an animal, a cat or a dog, that had been potty trained? But there was a time where that animal decided one day to just look at you and unload some bodily waste onto the floor. Anybody ever had that experience? Okay, a few of us had, and if you haven't, you can imagine what that would be like. Well, there was a fellow who decided to go into the temple area and do his business and say some choice words. If Josephus is anywhere right, he says that what that man did, I mean, it would be like going out and using a tree. The reaction was so forceful, 10,000 people were trampled in the ensuing riot. Yeah. Now, you just let that sink in. Not 100, not 1,000. 10,000 people were trampled because when people became aware of that, the temple had been defiled. It had been polluted. And again, he's not trying to get into the holy place. He just goes to some spot in the temple, and like I say, unloads a bit and says a few words. And I mean, it just whipped the people into a frenzy. I tell you that not to, you know, ruin your lunch, but I tell you that so that you will be able to have a second illustration of what it was like. I mean, you just almost can't, I just can't imagine what it would have been like. But I mean, these people, the temple was a precious area. And if you're going to go in there and do something that in their mind will somehow desecrate or defile that temple, you very well might be killed, and the whole city might be put into an uproar. I mean, this is, maybe for us, This is probably the poor illustration, but imagine what it would have been like to have lived when Pearl Harbor had been bombed and you're getting the news. Can you imagine the blood that was boiling in American veins? At least for some people, we're going to go and we're going to kill them. They've got to die. And I mean, it was that kind of reaction, but it was, in this case, not a whole country. You have a city, and it just lights the place on fire.
Like 9/11.
Yes, I guess if we wanted more, that was, I think it took us a little, well, probably the other one was great shock too. But once people finally realize what takes place, again, the blood really begins to boil. I mean, with the temple, you know, you're probably going to be a little faster as far as reaction, but yes. So thank you for the more modern illustration. Gary, and then maybe Don.
You know what the population of Jerusalem was at the time that Josephus wrote that?
No, I don't.
I was curious how to know how much of the...
Yeah, like I say, you always have to. I don't take him with a grain of salt, but I am always cautious because sometimes he seems to do some inflating. So, but I mean, even if it weren't 10,000, let's just say it was 500 people who were trampled. I mean, that is still big news. And it is, I think, still an illustration which helps picture what it was like back then. Don, did you have a thought?
Modern day Islam is probably as radical in certain areas as the Jews were back then. But if the Jews, you really can't fault the Jews somewhat because years and years and years of tradition. And even in the Old Testament, God has struck people dead because they didn't obey. Now they were seeing that these Gentiles were not obeying the Jewish law. So that was oil. Your blood was oil in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Paul was much more successful, wasn't he, outside of Jerusalem?
Yeah. I think for a couple of reasons. Number one, because of his history there with the persecution. But yes, if you can get people away a little bit from that culture, you know, it's like a person, they move across the country. For a while, what was home to them for 20 years, their friends are still there. They're thinking about that place. It's hard for them to disconnect. But the longer that they are away, the further that they are away, as time begins to pass, the easier it is for some of those connections to either be disconnected finally or be significantly weakened. And that certainly would have made it easier for the Jews. They could still go back and have the festivals that they might want to attend and maybe participate in. But those ties were substantially weakened, surely for most, because they were out of the area.
You see where James and the elders and apostles were concerned about Paul.
Yeah, I mean, they knew that they were sitting on a volcano. Right. I mean, it was a very volatile situation. So that's why I say, I think, and maybe they felt after Paul, arrives and things really start to kind of settle under their minds, they really very likely felt a sense of panic, and we've got to do something. But it just turned out not to be the best choice. I want to give you this as well. I wondered about this for a long time, and I guess I wasn't the only one. I read recently of a preacher. He asked this question in a college class. But they're saying that Trophimus was a Greek. That's sort of a euphemism. It's sort of code for what? Yeah, he's a Gentile, and he's someone who is not circumcised. Well, I wondered, as a newer Christian trying to read through the book of Acts and figure some of this stuff out, I wondered, how would they know he was an uncircumcised guy? How would they know he was a Gentile? And one fellow asked that in the college class, and I guess the professor had never been asked that question before. And when that came up, he just gave a two-word answer. He said, they checked and moved right on. So I... Older professor, I think. So I don't know that they would have checked every time, but I do think that there might have been cases where if... there had been a special need for that, they might have done that. But I do think that there were probably some other things that they could have done. Paul talks about in Romans chapter 11, verse 24, that there's some things that are by nature. And you would think that if you're a Jew, then again, by nature and covenant and all that stuff, you're going to be circumcised. We don't have to check. And if you are a Gentile, they knew what the culture was like. So again, we are going to assume and probably be right in most guesses or assumptions that you are not circumcised. Then there's another thing, and I've not traveled to the Middle East, but the people who have made an interesting observation. They have said that even though we might not be able, I mean, we could look at two people from the Middle East and say, well, I can't tell if you're from this ethnic, the Serbs, for example, and the Kurds. If we were in that part of the world, we might look at two people and say, I can't tell, you know, who's a sir. But I'm told that if you were in that area and you looked at the people, you would be able to say, you're the Kurd and you're the Serb. And the same thing with some other countries over there. They're able to tell, and maybe that distinction is pretty fine, but for us, what's difficult is apparently not so difficult for them. So some assumption, yes, but some of that probably was a good assumption when they connected him from Ephesus. And that was enough to just really blow the lid off things, as we're going to see, starting with verse 30. The city was moved, the people ran together, and it became a riot.